This is Audible.
Brothers of the Snake, written by Dan Abnett, read by Toby Longworth. Part 1. Grey Dawn. Undertaking to Baal Solok. Fear not the snake for his guile, nor his silence. Fear him for his speed at striking, the clenching strength of his coils, the armor of his scales, and the sharpness of his bite. Fear the snake, O enemies of man, for his coils encircle us, and his bright eyes, unblinking, watch over us forever. From the Lays of Proud Ithaca. In those days there was a circle of brothers, warriors of a metal unsurpassed in all the worlds of the reef stars, and they were called the Iron Snakes of Charybdis. And an oath they swore, a great undertaking, that for as long as their circle endured, they would stand watch over all the reef stars and, by force of arms, protect them from all the manifold powers of ruin, and they would know no fear. From the Charybdiad. Chapter 1. In the last days of the ripening season, in the northern cantons of Pythos, harvesters working late one hot, thundery evening in a field of swine corn and eating lily, saw a piece of lightning fall down onto the world behind the Pythoan hills. They knew it was a piece of lightning, for what else could it have been? It made a streak of white light across the soft blue evening clouds that was so bright that it left a memory of itself on their vision when they closed their eyes. When it landed, far away and out of sight, it made a crack like thunder. In the warm, sultry hours of those late days, summer storms regularly rumbled in and out of the sky, and sometimes broke with great violence. And now a piece of one had torn loose and fallen out of the air. So the story passed from village to village. In due time, a day or two after the event, the story reached the court of Samael Cater Hanfire, first legislator of the Pythoan cantons, brought into his zinc palace on the hill, along with a box of berries by a talkative fruiterer delivering from the produce market. It came to Hanfire by way of a kitchen boy, two gossiping maid slaves, and a dutiful butler. Legislator Hanfire was a wise and educated man, as one might expect a man of his station to be. He had been schooled in the academy at Fuse, and had travelled widely in his day, once as far as the thistle forests on the western tip. He was educated enough to know that lightning was not a solid commodity that simply fell from the sky from time to time. A slave was sent down to the produce market, which was by then closing its shutters for the day, and the fruiterer was summoned back to the palace. There he retold his story to Hanfire. He was a small, humble man, cowed by the presence of authority, and unduly ashamed of his hands, which had been stained almost blue by the juices of the fruit he traded in. He tried to keep them concealed in the folds of his patched apron. Hanfire listened carefully, and then made the man repeat the story, while the little metal golem at the foot of the first legislator's wooden throne recorded the account on a clattering hand press. Hanfire then thanked the fruiterer and offered him some wine and a plate of food, which the fruiterer refused, and 3 electrum coins, which the fruiterer hastily accepted before fleeing the zinc palace. Hanfire dined alone, reading back through the ink-impressed sheets that had rolled out of the golem's hand press, and by the time his steward brought the fruit posset and the small crystal thimble of Amasek, he knew what was now expected of him. A rider was sent, without delay, to the high legislator at Fuse, bearing a report written in Hanfire's own hand, requesting that the official receiver of Rec attends Pythos with all haste. The receiver of Rec, a tall, hard-boned man called Hensher, arrived by fleet coach with his entourage 2 days later. After consultation with First Legislator Hanfire, the receiver went up country into the hills to make his survey. Hanfire accompanied him. This was not usual, but Hanfire was an educated man and wonderfully curious about outworldly matters. The rising country was hot and dry. Summer storms lingered about the high places, and the sky was bruised with clouds like the skin of a windfall fruit. The string of coaches made good progress up the winding trackways, stopping at villages along the way to gather news. At each place, the locals came out in great crowds. They had never seen such important men in the flesh before, nor such finely garbed soldiers or such magnificent vehicles. They had never seen tailored clothes or laslock rifles or anything as inconceivable as the little metal golem. They humbly told the first legislator and the hard-boned receiver everything they knew, as well as many things they didn't. The story had grown, and it had been embellished, and trimmings of the very finest rumour had been attached to it. Yes, a piece of lightning had fallen from out of the sky, a great splitting noise it had made when it fell. Where? Well, beyond the hills there, towards the vale known as Charikon. Now it rolled about there, grinding and grumbling, lost and bewildered, sometimes lighting up the sky at night with firework flashes. Hanfire listened attentively. The receiver of Rec had his own golem make careful notes and seemed little impressed. At the hamlet of Peros, beside the tumbling headwater of the Pythoa, the locals solemnly swore that the piece of lightning had set fire to great spaces of wilderness wood behind Charikon, an inferno that had raged for days and nights until a storm downpour had quenched it. At Timaeus, a tiny place of low stone crofts, the inhabitants told of noises after dark and strange figures seen at a distance by shepherds on the hill pastures. The hamlet of Gelin, when they passed through it, was strangely empty, as if it had been vacated in a hurry.
"Simple folk fear things," the receiver told Hanfire as the coaches rattled onwards. "It is their way, as we might expect."
Hanfire shrugged, sitting back in his suede upholstered seat to feel the cool breeze of the coach's air fans.
"They would flee their homes? Run off into the night?"
"A piece of lightning has fallen from out of the sky," the receiver said, smiling the first smile Hanfire had seen cross his face. "It could be dangerous."
"But it's not?" asked First Legislator Hanfire.
"You wouldn't have summoned me if you thought so," replied the receiver, going back through the pages of the report his golem had produced during the day. "You did the right thing, of course, by sending for me. I admire your worldliness, sir."
Hanfire knew he had just been complimented, but he wasn't quite sure how.
"I'm sorry?"
The receiver looked up, peering through his half-moon spectacles.
"It's quite clearly a ship. A vessel that has foundered and crashed, just as you surmised. In the name of the High Legislator and the God Emperor who preserves all, we must locate the site and secure it."
"Is it dangerous, then?" Hanfire asked.
The receiver took down a zinc box from the luggage rack. It was a measuring device of some type, and it had been clicking like a cricket for the past day and a half.
"See?"
said the receiver.
"I'm not sure,"
replied Hanfire. The receiver adjusted a dial, and the clicking became louder and more intense.
"Residue," he said. "Contamination. It has permeated this landscape. Probably the spill from a drive system. Once we've found the site, the area should be confined."
"You've done this before?" asked Hanfire.
"I am the receiver of Rec," the other man said. "This is my job. Things fall from the heavens all the time, and thanks to men such as yourself, they are brought to my attention. There are fabulous treasures to be secured in the name of the High Legislator. Technologies, devices, precious metals, and if it is a vessel of our holy Imperium, there may be good human people in dire need of rescue."
Hanfire had been very much enjoying his journey into the hills with the receiver. It was a welcome change for him to spend time in the company of a learned, finely educated man. But now he felt some alarm. He was out of his depth. The receiver was so much more cosmopolitan than he was. He knew such things. He knew of wonders beyond the mortal sphere. He knew of space and its mysteries. He spoke of them matter-of-factly, as if they were commonplace.
"Have you ever—"
Hanfire began.
"Have I ever what, sir?"
the receiver asked. Hanfire felt rather silly asking the question, but he needed to know.
"Have you ever been beyond Baal Solok?"
The receiver of Rec smiled again.
"I was born on Idon, sir, and came here as a child.
The full, dizzying burden of that confession silenced First Legislator Hanfire for an hour or more. When he spoke again, in the rocking, bouncing carriage, it was to ask the other question that had been gnawing away at the edges of his thoughts.
What if it isn't?
The receiver of Wreck had been annotating the pages of the Golem's report with a silver quill. He looked up at the First Legislator.
Sir?
Hanfire took off his gloves and rubbed his hands, though the night was warm.
What if the vessel is not ours? What if it is other?
The receiver of Wreck sat back and put his papers aside.
The term we use is Xenos, sir. Alien in origin. It may be, but such occurrences are very, very rare.
But what if it is?
Asked Hanfire. He scolded himself inwardly for being so silly. It was just that he had never considered the idea before. The receiver reached up and pulled the communication thread. The fleet coach came to a halt, and the entire procession stopped around it. Henscher raised the window blinds and called out a command. The retinue of 20 men-at-arms hurried forward and assembled outside the coach, snapping to attention. Receiver Henscher had brought them with him from Fuse. They were very excellent men indeed, tall and strong, plated in quality field armor of khaki metal. They bore the finest and most modern laslocks that Hanfire had ever seen.
Ordinate Clue, the receiver called from the coach window. What is the principal order of the detachment?
To make safe the wreck and exterminate anything that is Xenos,
the master-at-arms barked from behind his visor. The receiver looked around at Hanfire.
These are good men, the best. Specialists, you might say. I pity the alien scum that meets with them in dispute.
We are quite safe. They are splendid indeed, Hanfire said.
He took his seat again.
Carry on, Clue,
Henscher called, and the procession began to roll forward again.
I haven't allayed your fears, have I, sir?
Receiver Henscher asked after a while.
Hanfire smiled. I have heard such things, sir. Stories, murky rumors, warning tales of the ruinous powers and the dread greenskins. They say they fall upon worlds and slay them utterly. I have been told especially of the thin, dark ones.
Ah, the primals. They are just a bad memory now.
Stories say that they have stripped many worlds in the reef stars with their cruelty. The primals may once have been fact, but they are not here. I don't believe they exist any more. They are legends. Stories,
First Legislator. Hanfire couldn't let it go.
But if they were, your fine detachment would be no match for them, would it?
Receiver Henscher sighed.
No, sir, not if the stories were true. But there is always ultimate salvation.
He leaned forward and showed Hanfire his signet ring. It was curiously wrought and marked with a double-looped serpent symbol.
If doom ever came to Baal Solok, this would be our answer.
Hanfire looked at the signet ring for a moment and then burst out laughing.
Now you're telling me stories, sir. The sign of the snake? That's a folk tale. Children are taught that the coils of the snake enfold us and that its eye watches over us unblinking, but that's just nursery talk.
Why?
Because it is, Henscher. Just a myth. Supreme warriors in grey armour waiting to sweep in and guard us? A child's tale.
Is the God Emperor of Mankind a myth, too, First Legislator?
Of course not.
Have you ever seen him?
No.
Yet you believe in him?
Upon my life, sir,
said Hanfire. Do not dismiss the snakes of Ithaca, then. They are real. They have made an undertaking to guard us until the end of time. I believe this, and so should you.
If we find calamity here, if my fine detachment of guards cannot cope, if, then I will send instruction to Fuse, and a petition will be made to the Brotherhood of the Snake. They are honor-bound to answer.
Has that ever been done?
Hanfire asked. Of course, said the receiver of Wreck.
When?
Henshaw frowned as he thought.
If memory serves, it was last done 633 years ago, in the time of High Legislator Ebrigan.
And the snakes of Ithaca came to Baal Solok's aid?
So the annals say. Hanfire shrugged and sat back. He didn't believe a word of it. The night was warm and light. Thunder rolled like a rock around the drum of the sky, and gentle sheet lightning lit the hills with an almost constant radiance, like a flickering twilight. It was high time they stopped for the night and rested the teams of quadruped servitors drawing the coaches. First Legislator Hanfire informed the receiver of Wreck that a hamlet called Tourmel lay just another half an hour away up the track. There they might find lodging, or at least a space to pitch their dormitory tents.
The Vale of Charicon is less than an hour away beyond Tourmel. We can be on it at first light.
This plan met with the receiver's approval. The procession rattled on, its lanterns lit now, through the fragrant groves of musk trees and sandalwood. And then it stopped. Hanfire climbed down out of the fleet coach after the receiver. The men-at-arms stood by the trackside, peering out into the dark woodland beyond the road. They had their weapons raised. Thunder rolled. In the shivering glow of the sheet lightning, they looked like statues.
What is it?
Hanfire asked, and the receiver shushed him. Hanfire swallowed. His unease returned. His pulse began to race.
Ordinate clue,
the receiver whispered.
Something in the trees, sir,
the soldier replied quietly.
It's been following us for the last 10 minutes.
Probably a lost goat, or a...
Hanfire began lightly.
Please, sir,
Henshaw whispered.
Quiet.
One of the other soldiers suddenly raised his hand and pointed out into the dark. Clue nodded and gestured for his men to move in. In a wide line, they stole forward into the trees. Henshaw followed them. He glanced back at Hanfire.
Stay with the coaches, First Legislator.
Hanfire obeyed. In a moment, both the men-at-arms and the receiver of Wreck had vanished into the thickets. A silence descended, stirred only by the grumbling storm and the wheezes of the servitor teams. Hanfire walked back to the fleet coach. Coachmen and servants had climbed down from their seats and stood around in small groups, quietly watching the woods. Hanfire could tell many of them were scared. In an effort to display the sort of composure that ought to distinguish a man of high office, Hanfire went back to his coach, got in, and sat down to read some tithe returns he'd brought on the trip. He took his zinc quill out of its case and determinedly began to make annotations in the margins of the forms by the light of the coach lamps. After a few minutes, he heard a pop from off in the distance. It sounded remarkably like the plosive sound that corks made when pulled from flasks of effervescent Fusian wine. There was another one shortly afterwards, then two more in quick succession. Hanfire put down his quill and climbed out of the coach. The footmen and drivers were still staring into the darkness. Two more pops, then an odd rattle, like pebbles rolling down the swaying blade of a push-pull saw. This was followed by another sound, muffled and far away.
That was a man,
one of the coachmen said.
Be quiet,
said Hanfire.
It was a man, sir,
the coachman insisted.
He cried out.
Hanfire turned and looked sternly at the coachman. The coachman's name was Petters, and he had been the First Legislator's team driver for 8 years. Hanfire couldn't bring himself to reprimand such a four-square, faithful retainer. He didn't have to. One look at Hanfire's disapproving expression, and Coachman Petters bowed.
My apologies, First Legislator.
Hanfire smiled.
There's nothing to be scared of, he told the people around him. Did you not see the fine fellows Receiver Henshaw brought with him? I doubt the High Legislator himself boasts a troop so formidable.
Some of them smiled. Hanfire was pleased they'd been even slightly soothed by his remark. Inside, once again, he didn't believe a word of it. They waited a while longer. Over the low mumble of the thunder, they heard more pops and more rattles. Then a cry again, unmistakable this time. The retainers looked at Hanfire. He could taste their fear.
Take your places,
he told them. "Get ready to proceed. Kester, unlock the gun chest and issue weapons to the coach riders." The retainers hurried to their places, some calling out orders. Hanfire turned back to look into the black thickets. More pops, four or five in a rapid, almost frantic series. Then a smell came to Hanfire on the night air. A curious smell. Dry and dead. He couldn't place it. Years before, he'd visited Marble Vault on the edges of the old desert. There, the hot wind had blown out of the empty quarters, filling the city with the desiccated mineral stink of the desert. It was like that, but not quite.
"Sir, we are ready to proceed,"
Petters called down from the driving board of the fleet coach. Hanfire raised his right hand.
"Wait, we should wait a moment longer."
They waited. The quad servitors snorted anxiously, pawing the turf. Behind him, Hanfire heard a rapid clicking. He thought it was one of the coach riders slotting shells into a repeating rifle. It was the receiver's zinc box up in the luggage rack. The measuring device. It was clicking as fast and loud as the finger cymbals the houris of Marble Vault clattered when they danced. Hanfire cleared his throat, swallowing hard again.
"We will proceed," he called out.
"Sir,"
Petters called from his vantage up on the fleet coach.
"Look! Look there!"
Hanfire looked. Something was moving, out in the trees. Something was approaching them. A figure. A running figure. Hanfire heard weapons cock.
"Hold your shots," he cried.
The running figure came closer, tearing and clawing through the underbrush in its haste. It came into view. It was the receiver of Wreck. His clothes were torn, and his hard-boned face pricked with blood by passing brambles. He ran towards Hanfire and the fleet coach.
"What is it?"
asked Hanfire.
"Get the coaches moving,"
Hensher said.
"Quickly now! What's going on?"
The receiver didn't answer. He ran to the rear of the fleet coach and dragged the canvas travel cover off the voxcaster set, secured on the luggage rack.
"What is going on?"
Hanfire demanded, hurrying after him.
"Run, First Legislator,"
the receiver said, urgently throwing switches to power up the vox set.
"Everyone here must run! Now! Tell them! Order them! Run south, in the name of the Golden Throne!" "You are scaring me, sir,"
said Hanfire.
"Good. I mean to. I've seen what's out there. Holy terror! My men! All my men!"
Hanfire glanced back at the dark woods, then looked at the receiver.
"What about your men?"
"They're dead,"
said the receiver. The First Legislator felt a cold, stony weight sink into his gut.
"What precisely do you mean?"
he asked, very clearly and carefully.
"I mean precisely that they're all dead,"
Hensher barked.
"Have you shit for brains, man? Are you stupid? I'm using simple bloody words."
"There's no need to be offensive,"
Hanfire said, smarting.
"I wish you had, sir," Hensher said.
"I'm staying here,"
Hanfire said.
"This is my land. My territory. I hold it in fealty to the High Legislator himself. I'll be damned if I flee from the soil I am elected to protect."
"Then you'll be damned,"
said the receiver. He climbed into the abandoned fleet coach and pulled a strongbox off the luggage rack. It had been sitting beside his clucking zinc device. The receiver opened the strongbox and took out two matched firing pieces, gold inlaid bolt pistols that had been nested in the red velvet slots within. He loaded both, quickly and surely, and handed one to Hanfire.
"You are a brave soul, First Legislator Hanfire," said the receiver of Wreck. "I wish I could have got to know you better."
"There's still time,"
Hanfire began.
"No, I'm afraid there's not,"
said the receiver of Wreck.
"I'm so sorry, sir. I have misjudged this. We are in trouble."
"You mean you and I?"
"I mean Baal Solok."
First Legislator Hanfire sighed and nodded. He took his place beside the receiver of Wreck in front of the empty fleet coach. The primals appeared. One or two at first, forlorn and rake-thin figures in the soft flicker of the lightning. Then more. A dozen. Two dozen. They were very black and hard, spiked figures that stepped quietly out of the thickets, gleaming in the stormlight. They seemed to Hanfire to have the character of hooks or thorns about them. So very glossy black and sharp. The receiver of Rec raised his pistol. Samuel Cater Hanfire did the same.
I really am so sorry,
the receiver of Rec said.
No need to be,
replied the first legislator. They began to fire. Behind them, drowned out by the roar of their pistols, the zinc device continued its furious clicking, and the voxcaster continued to pulse. Chapter 2. It appeared to be a joke, though the punchline wasn't obvious. Perdet Sueton Antoni, primary clerk to the High Legislator of Fuse, read the wafer again and saw no structure to the humour. Just 33, a nimble-fingered woman with a nimble mind, Antoni took her job seriously, so seriously that it had already cost her a marriage and most of her circle of friends. Women were only just beginning to advance in the legislature of Baal Solok, and no female had ever held a post so lofty or so ambitious as Perdet Sueton Antoni. It took tenacity and drive to overturn the old, hide-bound attitudes to gender and profession. A woman had to work twice as hard and be twice as good as any male counterpart to win advancement, even now the rules had changed and suffrage was recognized by law. Antoni was a slight woman who looked much younger than her actual age. On state occasions, she seemed swamped by the brocade and fur of her ceremonial garments and, many said, most of them male, by the stature of her office. For her, every day was a battlefield to get men to take her seriously.
"This is a joke," she said.
The duty rubricator in the palace's communique chamber shrugged ruefully.
"It is authentic as far as we can see, Dam. You'll note the thread line that declares the authority of the receiver of Rec."
Antoni already had. She had an eye for such things. She didn't need to be told.
"But it's a request for—"
She stopped and laughed. The rubricator laughed too, soullessly, just trying to keep her company. Antoni stopped laughing, and so did the rubricator.
"This hasn't happened before," she said.
"Please, Udam, it has."
"When?"
The rubricator shrugged.
I'd have to consult. Maybe 500 years ago?
"This is a joke," said Antoni again.
"I would hope so," said the rubricator. "So much paperwork to fill out if it's genuine."
Antoni looked at the wafer again. She knew she could simply ignore it. That was in her power. She could ignore anything she didn't want to bother the High Legislator with. But she'd not won her position in the world by ignoring the rules. No one knew the legislator statutes more thoroughly than Perdet Sueton Antoni. She was a woman of process, a woman of letters. This wafer, however ridiculous it seemed, carried about it the seal of urgency and proper procedure. Antoni knew that some protocols simply couldn't be ignored, even if it seemed daft. Just because something happened once every few thousand years didn't mean it wasn't still important.
"Be advised," Antoni told the rubricator. "I have to treat this as genuine. Inform your staff. If it's a hoax, we'll find out who's behind it. Until then, stand ready. I have to take the authority at face value. I have to take this to the High Legislator."
"Rather you than me," the rubricator said.
Antoni nodded. "Carry on," she said. As she hurried away down the long, draughty corridor, the rubricator turned to his staff, clapped his gnarly hands, and urged them to meet emergency conditions. Fra Kesh Azur, High Legislator of Fuse, was watering his high garden with a little green-spouted can. The high garden was a long terrace on the roof of the palace, marvellously festooned with weeds and scrubby plants that the High Legislator would not allow to be pruned or cut back. He fancied himself a botanist, and this was his collection of precious samples. He had written several heavy books on the subject, all of which had been dutifully published, all of which sat, unread, in the palace library. Years before, the high garden had afforded a fine view across the roofs and chimneys of Fuse. Nowadays, it was hard enough to locate the edge railings in all the undergrowth, let alone see out. The High Legislator was dressed in a housecoat, a long robe of silk. The tie sash had long since been mislaid, and the High Legislator pulled the robe shut around his portly frame with one hand. Princeps, his attack dog, a black satin beast of hard muscles and slavering snout, trotted behind him through the weeds, leashless.
"My Lord Azur," Antoni
called from the doors of the garden room. The High Legislator was invisible amongst the sprouting mosswarts and climbing dreadle.
My lord?
Princeps stiffened and growled, hulking his back like a fighting bull.
Stay now, Princeps, my good boy,
muttered the High Legislator, setting down his watering can.
That's just Antony. You know Antony, don't you? Yes, you do.
The hound stopped growling and padded off through the overgrown garden to meet their guest. Antony stiffened as she saw the dog approaching. It circled her twice.
Let him sniff you,
a voice called from out of the spidery green.
Antony, let him smell you. Then he won't harm you.
Antony held out a fist. The attack dog came to it, sniffed it, and licked it. Antony shuddered. With a grumble like distant thunder, the attack dog padded off into the garden room and began fidgeting with a bone.
Antony?
My lord?
Azure emerged out of the weeds.
Hello, my dear. What's the matter?
Antony gave the wafer to the High Legislator.
A joke, I believe, she said. But I am constrained by protocol to take it seriously.
Azure peered at the paper slip.
Henshire sent this?
It seems so, sir.
From where?
The Pythoan Canton, sir.
Never been there. I'm told they're horribly rural. Horribly rural. Who's our man up in that neck of the woods?
Hanfire, sir.
Azure paused, thinking. He shook his head.
No, don't know him.
He was here last winter feast. Smart fellow, very proper.
Azure shrugged.
Still nothing.
Should we take this seriously, sir? Antony asked.
If it was from this Hanfire.
Hanfire.
Well, whatever his name. Then, no. But Henshire solicited this signal.
The High Legislator paused and glanced around his garden. His robe fell open. Antony looked away at some nearby sunflowers.
The official receiver of Wreck ought to know what he's talking about. Wouldn't you say, Antony?
Yes, sir. Could you maybe pull your robe, with respect, closer to you?
What?
I was saying the High Garden's looking particularly lovely, sir.
I'm happy you think so.
The High Legislator looked again at the wafer.
This is a protocol matter, Antony.
Yes, sir.
I mean, fake or real, this is a matter of protocol.
It is, sir.
How long has it been?
I check, sir. 633 years.
Azure nodded and deadheaded a few tube roses.
If this is a scare, I'll have heads on pikes for it.
Yes, sir.
If it isn't... Antony, you know what to do.
Sir, do you really want me to...
The receiver of Wreck is no idiot. He wouldn't have done this unless he expected us to take proper action. If it turns out to be his idea of foolery, then I'll flay him alive and use his skull as a goblet.
Henshire never struck me as a man fond of games, Antony said.
Me neither. Go and set things in motion, please.
I will, sir,
said Antony.
The Alarum Chapel was actually a basement room underneath the Holy Cathedral in the heart of Fuse. Time and circumstance had layered buildings above and around it. The door to it was locked. Antony had to wait for several minutes while the beadle found a key.
Been no call for it in such a long time,
the beadle said, blowing dust off the key. He regarded the primary clerk with eyes rendered dull by cataracts.
Begging your pardon, damn, but is this...
Antony cut the beadle off.
I'm certain.
The door swung open with a drawn-out, lethargic creak. Antony walked alone into the cool, dark crypt, and ancient glow-globe systems, sensing either her body heat or motion, slowly came alive, growing in radiance until the chapel was bathed in a pearly, green shimmer. On the stone shelves and alcoves around her, Antony saw urns and amphora, thick with dust, painted with the figures of warriors. Grey-clad warriors from the sky. 633 years earlier, they had come to Baal Solok's aid. As she wandered forward, Antony studied the stylized painted figures, legs splayed, lances lifted to strike.
This is all so much nonsense, she said to herself.
The plinth was made of ebony, or some black stone that was warm to the touch. It was surprisingly small and gave off a faint scent of energized heat, like an astropath enclave. Old systems, still ticking over. Antoni felt the surfaces of the plinth carefully, wiping away the accumulated dust with the corner of her cuff. Antoni had brought the codex with her. She took the small, brass-clasped volume out of her coat pocket, opened it, and began to read. No one had performed this action in a very long time, and nobody had even practiced it. Some court procedures were rehearsed on a regular, formal basis, but not this one. For a moment, Antoni felt a brief connection to the last person who had taken this codex out of the palace library and opened it. Another primary clerk, his name, without doubt he had been a he, now lost, 633 years before. The instructions were fairly simple. Antoni laid the codex open on the top of the plinth and saw how the leaves naturally fell apart on the right page. Fabric memory. Her predecessor had pressed the book open and laid it just where Antoni had now done, so as to be able to consult it. She took off her signet ring and fitted it into the seal reader. The double-headed snake motif locked in and turned like a key. A rectangular panel slid open in the front face of the plinth, allowing more warm air to escape, and revealed a small finger-touch keypad and several other small controls. The codex contained a list of numeral sequences to type in, with their corresponding meanings. Antoni spent a moment deciding which was the most appropriate. She settled on a general request for assistance, and nervously tapped in the designated code. Then she carefully followed the rest of the instructions. The final touch. A simple, recessed button, edged in brass. Antoni hovered her index finger above it for a long time, then pressed it. She wasn't sure what to expect, though she anticipated something impressive. There was a click, then a silence. Then a low groan that gathered force until it became a lingering murmur that hung in the air. Heat radiated from the black plinth. The chapel lights dimmed for a second, ever so slightly. Then there came another sound, so deep she felt it rather than heard it. She backed away from the plinth, slightly alarmed. The sounds all died away, and silence returned. The plinth went dead, except for one slow, blinking blue light. Antoni picked up the codex and read on. There was nothing else. She was done. She walked out of the chapel, the lights fading in sequence behind her. The beadle was waiting by the door.
"When do you start, Dam?"
the beadle asked. "I'm finished," said Antoni. "Lock the door." Chapter 3. 2 months later, a star appeared in the western sky. For 3 hours it glowed against the curdled, grey dawn clouds. And those citizens of Fuse who had not by then fled for the south, leaving their properties boarded and locked, regarded it as an ill omen. A tardy ill omen at that. All the bad things an omen like that might presage had surely come to pass already. The star grew brighter and larger. It divided into 3 points of bright light, then came closer still, and revealed itself to be a dark shape upon which 3 bright lights were mounted. It was a ship. One of the palace guards woke Perdet Suite and Antoni, and the primary clerk hurried to the high windows along the west wing of the palace to look. Her feelings had changed a great deal in the previous 2 months. What had been puzzlement and suspicion had turned into dismal fear. And now, suddenly, to hope. "Assemble a retinue," she yelled. "An honor guard! Now! Quickly!" Her voice was drowned out as the ship passed over Fuse with a roar like rushing wind. Antoni left the palace grounds in a 2-wheeled gig, goading the servitors. She'd barely had time to pull on her formal robes. Her men-at-arms rushed out after her on foot, clattering shields and weapons. They left the marching band behind. It was taking the players too long to assemble their instruments.
"Where did it go?" Antoni shouted to her troopmaster. "Did anyone see it land?" "The lights came down on the water meadows," the troopmaster replied. "Down beyond the state park." They hurried that way. The ground became too boggy for the gig, and Antoni dismounted, picking up the hem of her robes so she could run with the men-at-arms. She saw a shape through the trees ahead, a fog of water vapor slowly dissipating in the dawn. She smelled a curious perfume of heat and chemicals and mud. "Quickly now," she called to the men strung out in the muddy grasses around her. "And look smart, you there, straighten that tunic."
"Yes, Dam."
Antoni was brought up sharply by the steady hand of the troopmaster on her arm.
"What?"
"This could be anything, Dam. This could be more of them. Let me lead the way."
The thought hadn't occurred to Primary Clark Antoni. It chilled her. She nodded, ashamed of her sudden cowardice. The troopmaster moved forward, calling orders to his men to spread out. Antoni followed them. The steam was clearing. A few old willows stood limp along the edge of the water meadow, and beyond them lay the ship. Fierce, sleek, its galvanized hull was scored and pitted, its landing stanchions half sunk in the soft earth. Antoni frowned. It seemed to be a very small ship. The advancing men-at-arms came to a halt well shy of the landed vessel. They aimed their weapons at it. The gray dawn was very close and still, except for the croaking and fluting of waterfowl in the meadows and the estuary beyond. Strands of mist unfurled themselves out through the air like gauze. A hatch opened. A ramp extended with a loud whirr. Waterbirds wading close by broke and fled aloft in a panic of beating wings. A lone figure came down the ramp, just a silhouette in the misty air. It crouched down at the foot of the ramp, busy with some task. Antoni peered forward. What was it doing? Anointing itself? Drinking? The figure rose to its feet again. A voice suddenly rang out of nowhere and everywhere, amplified.
"Unless you mean to be my enemy," it declared, "stop aiming your weapons at me."
The men-at-arms slowly, nervously, lowered their firearms. Antoni pushed forward, past the troopmaster, and approached the figure.
"I am Perdet Sueton Antoni, primary clerk to—"
She trailed off and came to a halt. The craft ahead of her was certainly small, but the figure at the foot of its ramp was not. He was a giant, cased in armor that was gunmetal gray, edged in red and white. His head was bare, a heavy skull on a broad neck, black hair pleated in coils around his crown. He seemed two or even three times the mass of an ordinary adult male, and even the tallest men-at-arms in Antoni's retinue would only have come up to the giant's chest.
"Oh, God,"
Antoni murmured. The giant took a step off the end of the ramp towards her. With a gasp, Antoni sank to her knees, squelching in the mud.
"There's no need for that,"
the giant said. His voice was so deep, so immense, Antoni felt it quiver her diaphragm.
"Please get up, primary clerk."
Antoni looked up, but did not rise. She stared into the giant's face. It was massive and angular, like a mountain cliff, but the eyes were sharp and alive.
"You sent for me."
I mean the people of Baal Solok. I sent a signal, just a signal, according to the old law of undertaking, a signal to the Iron Snakes of Ithaca, for help.
"I am Priad of Damocles of the Iron Snakes. Your signal was heard, and I have answered it. Where is the enemy?"
Antoni got up, her robe tails wet with mud.
"In the north, north of here."
"Number and disposition? Type?"
"I don't know. All I know is that the primals have attacked our world."
"Primals. That's an old word. I haven't heard it used in years. Come with me, please."
The giant gestured for Antoni to follow him back into the ship. Antoni hesitated. The giant turned back.
"I'm sorry. I was getting ahead of myself. There's some ceremony, I suppose. Your local leader wishes to feast me. Something like that."
Antoni shook her head.
"Our high legislator went into hiding 6 weeks ago, when the primal attacks became more intense. We have no proper welcome for you, sir. I only hesitate because—"
"What?"
"I'm afraid of going into your ship. I've never—"
"I see," That's all right. It's perfectly safe. It's just like a regular sea boat. Please come with me. I need to know what you know, if I'm going to help you.
Antoni nodded and scrambled forward to join the giant. Near the foot of the ramp, she slipped in the mud, and the giant shot out a hand to grasp her arm and steady her. The grip was like a bear trap. The giant's huge gauntlet entirely enclosed Antoni's hand.
All right, Primary Clark?
Yes. I was wondering...
What?
You are a snake.
Yes.
You are alone.
Yes.
Antoni smiled and nodded.
I understand. The ship seemed so small. When do the other snakes arrive?
What others? Replied the giant.
Chapter 4 Antoni followed the giant warrior up the ramp into the belly of the ship. Their footsteps pealed echoes off the metal decking.
I don't understand, Antoni said.
The interior of the ship had a strange, musty smell of hot metal, scented oils, bleach, and ozone. They were in a kind of hold space with a black grill floor and harsh greenish lamps recessed into the verdigreed walls. All the surfaces were scuffed and worn, utilitarian. A steady, throbbing click and gurgle came from behind the wall plating as the ship's systems cooled and shut down. It neither looked nor smelled anything like Antoni's idea of a space vessel. The giant strode across the grill floor and attended to a row of machine units with glowing screens mounted along one side of the hold space.
What don't you understand, Primary Clark?
Antoni cleared her throat.
You are alone. You come to us alone.
Yes, said the giant. That is the standard way. If a client world solicits Ithaca for aid, the chapter master traditionally authorizes one warrior to respond. And one warrior usually suffices.
But if the problem is grave, she began, surely one man is not enough.
I can make that assessment. Others can be summoned. I don't think they will be needed on this occasion.
With respect, the territories of the legislature are under assault. There have been raids, quite barbaric raids, and many deaths. Towns and villages have been burned. We have sent in our best troops. None have returned. None have ever been seen again. The primals
are fiends, said the giant. I know. I am acquainted with their handiwork. You were lucky, in fact.
Lucky, she echoed.
In the last 6 months, my company has been engaged in a sporadic contest with the dark... with primal factions in this stellar neighborhood. A number of skirmishes on half a dozen worlds. We scattered them, and now my battle group is occupied hunting the remnants of them down and mopping them up. The chapter house relayed your signal to my battle barge. We were just a few systems away. It was deemed convenient to drop me off as we came by. Primary Clark, how do you suppose we answered your signal so quickly?
Quickly, she replied. It's been 2 months.
The giant looked at her with a faint, forgiving smile.
What did you say your name was, Primary Clark?
Perdit Sueton Antoni, she said.
Well, Perdit Sueton Antoni, you are clearly an educated woman. How far away do you suppose Ithaca is?
I don't know, she confessed.
To the nearest parsec, maybe.
I don't know what a parsec is, sir.
The giant nodded.
Ithaca is a long, long way away, Primary Clark. It would take the Iron Snakes 10 or 12 months at the minimum to get here from there. We were in the neighborhood. Count yourself lucky.
I didn't, she began.
Didn't what?
I didn't realize space was so big. Ithaca is in the reef stars, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And the reef stars alone are so vast that it would take a year to cross from Ithaca to Baal Solok.
No time at all, where space is concerned. It would take 3.5 years to cross the reef stars group, and that is just a small part of the whole Imperium. Galactically speaking, Ithaca is close by, a bright yellow star which you might see in summertime, close to the western horizon.
You know where Ithaca is in our sky?
It was the first thing I checked when I arrived. I like to know where I am in relation to it.
A foible, you might say. Antoni felt slightly light-headed.
I'd like to sit down, she said.
The giant clanked over to her and wrenched down a foldaway seat built into the corroded wall. She perched on it.
Thank you. Could I also trouble you for a cup of water?
He paused.
I don't have... I mean, we don't need supplies. Rations. We can operate for a long time without...
She nodded.
I understand. It's all right.
No,
he said.
It's not. A drink of water.
He reached down and took out a flask from a sheath strapped to his armored thigh plate. The flask was tubular, copper, banded with straps of dull zinc. He unstoppered it and handed it to her.
It will be brackish, I'm afraid.
She sipped. It was brackish, but the water was welcome anyway.
Thank you,
she said, handing it back. The giant just nodded again, restoppered the flask, and put it away. He stepped across the hold space and pressed a series of heavy, wall-mounted pressure switches. On the left side of the hold, a section of wall retracted, revealing equipment, armor, and weapons hung from secure brackets. Antoni saw long copper lances, a pair of shields, and an enormous firearm that she knew, just by looking at it, would be too heavy for her to lift. On the right side, a section hatch furled up to expose a secondary hold in which a craft of some kind hung in a supporting frame. To Antoni, it looked a little like a rowboat, but grey and armoured, with seats for two and heavy weapons mounted on the prow. The giant threw some switches, and power began to pulse through to the small craft, charging its engines. The giant returned to his bank of monitor screens.
They've milked out, he said.
What?
My scanners. I'd hoped to get a decent topographic scan as I came in and fix a position for the hostiles, but they've milked out. Blind. Radiation, that's my guess.
Radiation? What's that?
I think the primals might have crashed here, Primary Clark. It's not an invasion, it's a forced landing. Their drive core has leaked, perhaps even exploded, polluting hundreds of square kilometers. The return is so harsh, I can't get a decent track.
I can show you where they are, Antoni said. In the palace. I have maps.
I'd appreciate that,
the giant said. The men-at-arms fell back as she led the giant up through the water meadows from his ship. She chatted all the way, and the giant made little response. He simply trudged after her, towering like a high man from the old stories, occasionally steadying her when she slipped or stumbled. As they walked in through the arches of the palace, the giant said,
It's unusual, isn't it, for a female to hold such status?
Yes, it is, she replied. I am the first woman to achieve the rank of primary clerk.
I earned it. I have no doubt of that.
On Baal Solok, we are proud of the way we have recognized gender rights. This is a modern, enlightened age.
Yes, said the giant, smiling again. I rather suppose it is.
There, she said.
The giant studied the charts Antoni had rolled out.
High country, then.
Up beyond Charikon, hills and vales. Most of the villages there have been razed. The entirety of the Pythoan cantons is considered a no-go.
The giant considered the maps, blinking from time to time. Each blink was matched with a click.
What is that? Antoni asked.
I'm simply storing data.
Your eyes are like a camera.
Yes, I suppose you could think of it that way.
His eyes clicked again. Now he was looking at her.
You recorded my pict? She asked.
Yes, Primary Clark. Target recognition. I'd hate to shoot you by accident.
Why would you? Antoni asked.
Because I know what you're going to ask of me.
When?
Tomorrow.
Chapter 5. It was, again, a cold grey dawn. Mist, heavier than the previous days, draped like swaddling around the precincts of Fuse, making all sounds strange and hollow. Antoni came out into the damp chill of the palace yard. Sentries stood around in attendance, and somewhere a drill master was ordering a change of guard shifts. The bellowing voice was twisted and transmuted by the leveling mist. Antoni put down her small traveling case. She was dressed in a woolen winter roving suit of shirt and trousers, with waterproofed leathers worn over. She waited. Princeps and three of the High Legislator's other attack dogs roamed the yard.
The High Legislator had insisted, before his departure, that his trusted hounds should remain behind to safeguard the palace. Antony stayed well out of their way. A new sound throbbed through the mists, an engine sound. Antony looked up. So did the sentries in the yard, and the dogs too. The engine note came closer, then died away outside the palace yard gate. A moment later, heavy footfalls crunched in through the yard entry. The giant, in his hulking armor, appeared through the mist. The dogs immediately ran towards him, growling, hackles up. "Stop them," Antony called to the nearest sentry, but he just shrugged, helpless. The giant came to a halt as the dogs came for him. He sank to one knee and let out a swift, sharp whistle, a sound that Antony couldn't imagine a human mouth making. The dogs immediately dropped onto their bellies and put their chins flat on the wet cobbles. One of them let out a little whine. The giant, still kneeling, wiggled his metal-gloved fingers and Princeps got up, ran forward with his head low, and allowed the giant to pet him. Princeps gurgled and rolled over, legs splayed. The giant rose again, pointing a finger at Princeps. The attack dog settled down on its belly once again. The warrior stepped past the supine dogs and came over to Antony.
"Fine dogs. War dogs?"
"Yes."
"Very fine animals."
"How did you—"
she began, then thought better of it.
"You're dressed for traveling,"
he remarked.
"I intend to come with you. There are, I believe, 2 seats aboard your traveling machine."
She looked up at him.
"This is the question you knew I would ask."
"Yes,"
he said.
"I won't make an argument. You have summoned me to accomplish a task, and you wish to see it done. It is normal for client states to require a witness or inspector to oversee our actions."
"So you will take me with you?"
"Primary clerk, we have learned from experience it's better to say yes than to refuse and have someone like you tail us. I need to know where you are so I can keep you safe. There are basic conditions, however. You will do as I say at all times, without comment or question. You will accompany me only so far. Once we reach the tactical edge of the operational area, you will stay put and allow me to continue alone."
"Now wait, I—"
"These conditions are non-negotiable, Primary Clerk. You may come with me to the edge of the fighting area, and then wait for me. I am very capable, but I cannot guarantee your safety once we are in a shooting zone. You will wait for me at the tactical edge. Once I'm done, I will return for you and allow you to review the scene and assure yourself that I have been thorough. Do you agree to these terms?"
"I suppose so."
"You do or you don't. If you don't believe you can abide by them, then you're staying here."
"Very well."
"Are you armed?" the giant asked.
"Can't you tell?"
she asked. He looked at her, and there was another click as he blinked.
"Battery source, upper left-hand pocket, a communicator, or a recording device. Picked recorder, hip pocket. Battery source, collar and spine of overcoat. A heating element, I'm guessing. Charge pistol, lower coat pocket. Laz?"
"Yes."
"Show me."
Antony took out the small Laz pistol she'd checked out of the palace armory that morning. She handed it to him. He looked at it for a moment. It seemed like a child's toy in his massive gauntlets. Then he tossed it away to the nearest sentry, who caught it neatly.
"No firearms, Primary Clerk. I must have absolute say over weapons discharge. Apart from the enemy, of course. I can't permit you to carry a handgun. In an emergency, it could confuse things far too much."
He paused.
"I smell black powder, and trace physoline from ignition caps."
"The sentries here are armed with solid slug sidearms."
"That's not it." "Please?"
Antony sighed and removed the percussion pistol from her trouser pocket. He took it, disarmed it, and threw it to the sentries.
"Nice try, though," the giant said.
"How am I supposed to protect myself?"
Antony asked.
"You're not. That's my job. That's the point. Anything else? Speak now."
"I have a blade. A sheath knife."
"Show me."
She pulled up the cuff of her right trouser leg. The blade was strapped in a scabbard to her calf.
"I'll allow that. But hook it to your waistband where I can see it, and you can reach it.